Bureau, News of Fairbanks and Alaska.
Military units in Alaska, like those around the nation, were put on alert last night. We have comments on that alert from Congressman Don Young and U.S. Senator Mike Gravel. And the state legislature is continuing to hear testimony on the state's oil and gas laws. Good afternoon. This is Ted Lane reporting Broadcast Center News at 5:15. Alaskan command officials said late today that a precautionary alert is still in force for Alaska's military operations. That alert was called last night as part of an alert for all U.S. troops in response to the latest Middle East crisis. The possibility exists, however, the alert could be called off. Officials in Washington, D.C. are said to be considering a selective reduction of the alert, one that could begin later tonight. Meanwhile, the Adjutant General for the Alaska National Guard, Major General Bruce Stasser, said the National Guard in Alaska was not put on alert. Stasser said that they are taking precautionary measures to get geared up in case something does happen. Those measures, he said, include a review of alert lists and procedures. Congressman Don Young had these comments on the alert.
Overnight developments on the diplomatic and military fronts have pushed the United States and the Soviet Union into an adversary relationship over the on-again, off-again ceasefire in the Mideast. Military bases in Alaska, like those around the world, are now on alert. President Nixon ordered this early morning as a result of a Soviet threat to send troops to the Mideast to enforce the ceasefire. Officials here in Washington say Soviet enforcement of the United Nations ceasefire could put Russian troops on the side of the Arab combatants and broaden the scope of the latest Arabian-Israel war. What the United States faces today, at this very moment, is another Cuban Missile Crisis. And as President Kennedy did 11 years ago, I am confident President Nixon and Secretary of State Kissinger will convince the Soviets to cool off and back down. During the Korean War, an international peacekeeping force was put together to enforce the ceasefire there. If the United States can convince the Soviet Union to take a hands-off stance in this latest conflict, we may yet see another international peacekeeping force sent in. It happened during the 1956 war in Egypt. I hope it will be done again. Every day the Mideast war continues, the threat of involving the superpowers, Russia and the United States, grows. The Mideast war must stop. If the combatant nations refuse to stop the fighting, the nations of the world must intervene and bring it to an end. Having American forces on alert around the world does not represent a threat to world peace. It shows, in the strongest way possible, that the United States is prepared to back up its diplomatic negotiations with force. It shows the other nations of the world that the U.S. means business about peace.
A spokesman for the Alaska Disaster Office in Anchorage said there has been no alert with the civil defense offices in the state in connection with the military alert. The disaster office, acting on behalf of the governor, is keeping in touch with the Alaska command concerning any changes in the state of alert. Governor Egan said he hopes the United Nations Security Council will be able to resolve the Middle East conflict in a way that will preclude any likelihood of a dangerous confrontation there. Egan also said he hopes the solution is one in which the powers overlooking any ceasefire would not be from the big powers, such as the U.S., Russia, or Britain. U.S. Senator Mike Gravel is in Fairbanks today. He was questioned about the recent developments in the Middle East by our news director, Larry Carpenter.
What does this worldwide military alert mean to you?
Well, I'm very surprised to the extent of it, Larry. As you know, it's the first time that we've gone this extensively since the Pueblo situation. And of course, we don't know the particulars. He's brought in the leadership of the Congress and briefed them this morning. I don't know the exchange of information between the Soviet Union and the United States. All we know is Dr. Kissinger went over there and things were going along very well. We insist that we have a peacekeeping force from the United Nations rather than the Soviets and ourselves. So I just don't know whether or not the gravity of the situation warrants this type of an alert situation. I do know that I have the same question mark as most Americans, is that, you know, with the harassment he has domestically over the possibility of impeachment, is he trying to pull some patriotic stunt, so to speak, of making himself more into the role of the commander-in-chief to take away from the domestic problems relative to impeachment? If that's the case, then it's a very, very cruel hoax and a very, very serious one. I don't know what the facts are, and I'll reserve my judgment until more information comes out.
That question or that thought was asked of Dr. Kissinger at his news conference this morning, and he replied somewhat upset that that question was symptomatic of what's happening to the country. What did he mean by that?
Well, if he's talking about symptomatic, meaning the lack of faith and a credibility in the president, then of course he's right. But then again, it wasn't the country that brought about this lack of credibility, it was the president himself. So that he can be angry over that. If this is a scenario, then they have every reason to be angry because people aren't just buying it the way they're putting it out.
We're just out of Vietnam, sort of. Are we being drawn into another war now in the Mideast?
I hope not, and I think the Congress many times doesn't act with the courage that it should. But I'm sure in this particular situation that we'll demand more information before we go ahead and permit certain things to take place. But of course, the executive has an edge on us. He can do things more rapidly than we can. But there's a lot of talk about whether or not the president is balanced or under emotional stress. I hope that the leadership of the Congress that has close contact with him will keep that in mind, and I'm sure they will, and so that we in the Congress could act at any time. I'm subject to being called back and could be back at my desk in Washington in 12 hours. I'm prepared to do just that. But in the absence of that, I plan on going back on Monday.
You would oppose the introduction of any U.S. troops in the Mideast?
It would depend upon the situation. I would say at this point, yes, I would oppose our sending troops to the Mideast. However, I have supported and will vote for the $2 billion request for supplying arms so that we have a parity in that area. And I think that that policy is a policy that will do the job, will be successful. And so I think it's in our interest to maintain parity. And I think with the proper parity, we won't have to send, or there'll be no need to send troops in. And at this point in time, I just wonder if there's any need to place the entire armed forces of the United States around the world on the alert.
That was U.S. Senator Mike Gravel. Gravel is scheduled to meet with Fairbanks area teachers at 7:30 tonight at the home of the president of the Fairbanks Education Association, H.O. Red Williams. The meeting will be at 333 Glacier Street and is being held to mark National Education Week in Fairbanks. For the first time since it convened 8 days ago, the special session of the legislature may recess this weekend. Associated Press correspondent John Greeley has details from Juneau.
This special legislative session on oil laws continues to drift in a whirlpool of conflicting testimony. Legislators have been listening and listening and listening again to their consultants tear into Governor Egan's compromise with the oil industry. There is a steadily climbing resistance in the Senate to dropping most of the state regulatory controls approved last year and opposed by the industry. The bills appear to be in better shape in the House, where Speaker Tom Fink has the repeal of state regulatory control as his top priority. Most of the early action is centering on the governor's proposed statewide property tax. The regulatory issues most likely will be saved for last. But the House and the Senate have yet to get together in a common direction. After 9 days of constant work, lawmakers most likely will recess this weekend. There's a good chance for things to start happening early next week. Tomorrow, the House has a vote on tap on the property tax bill, but it's only the first step in the long legislative process. In Juneau, this is John Greeley for the Associated Press.
Congressman Don Young says the Alaska Pipeline Authorization Bill has been placed on the House calendar for a final vote a week from tomorrow. A spokesman for Young says that although the bill is printed on the House calendar for next Wednesday, the House vote will come on Friday. The spokesman said that's because the senators on the conference committee are out of town, and the Senate will probably not vote on the bill until Monday. Senator Ted Stevens has predicted the bill could be signed and sent to the president sometime in the first week of November. The State House Resources Committee today approved a measure allowing the state to lease land without public auction for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Terminal at Valdez. Gutted from the bill was a provision giving the state an option to sell land for pipeline-related use. The substitute bill sent to the House Finance Committee contains a 55-year lease provision with an open-ended renewal option for an additional 55 years. A former Justice Department attorney, John Lamont, testified today before the State Resources Committee on antitrust aspects of oil operations. W.J. Lamont told the committee that Justice Department attorneys are proceeding with an antitrust suit against oil companies that will own the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Associated Press correspondent Steve Weiner has details from Juneau.
A Washington attorney who for 26 years worked with the Justice Department's antitrust division has told legislators that owners of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline face a probable federal antitrust suit. W.J. Lamont testified today before the Senate Resources Committee, and he says the suit will be aimed only incidentally at the Trans-Alaska line. Lamont says three oil companies, Exxon, British Petroleum, and Atlantic Richfield, control a quarter of U.S. oil reserves. Lamont, who left the department in June 1972, was asked if the case is proceeding.
the time I left, the case was still proceeding. About a month ago, they called me in to talk with the new staff that had been assigned since that time. They are still proceeding. They will intend to proceed, I'm certain. If they don't, to be perfectly honest with you, I think I will do an awful lot of yelling. But what they are proceeding with respect to is not to stop the pipeline, but to stop a rather monopolistic control organization. Did you ever stop to think that you have, within three companies' hands, operating in very close joint venture, a greater degree of total control over the crude oil markets of the West Coast, and indeed of the entire United States, than the state of Texas had in the years in which Texas held the umbrella over the industry and virtually controlled prices and supplies?
Lamont told legislators that if they retain regulatory
in the first week of November.
When you think of Chinese
Manassa facility in Fairbanks, and also about the Middle East crisis.
Mike, what's the status of the proposed NASA Earth Resources Station that's been proposed for the Fort Wainwright area?
Well, we're still waiting on the study that we've asked, or the evaluation of the application that we asked of Dr. Fletcher. At the time, we gave him, I believe, 45 or 60 days. And so he's probably got another 15 days, 3 weeks before we can get an answer. I hope it will be favorable. I think it will be favorable. I see no difficulty in that regard. I think that the proposal that was put forth by the city and the borough was a very fine proposal.
With all of the Alaskan military bases being put on alert today, could you comment on that and on the Mideast crisis?
Well, first off, on the for the alert, I don't know why they're put on alert. The last time this happened was when we had the Pueblo, and of course everybody knew that the Pueblo, the ship had been seized, and the tensions were running very high. But right now, all we know is that Richard Nixon has put the nation on the alert, a war alert, to go to war with who, we don't know. The Russians have done nothing bellicose that we're aware of, and it just seems very, very odd at this point in time that we would have a national emergency when there doesn't seem to be an emergency around that exists to warrant this kind of action. It raises a big question mark in my mind. The president was supposed to address the nation. He canceled that. He was supposed to come forward and answer questions of the press. And then when Dr. Kissinger was asked, well, just maybe, is this alert sort of a disguise to try and rally support around the president and push Watergate behind? He got very angry with that. But I don't know. That's probably the only conclusion one can come to until we find out what the alert's for. I think it's not right for the president to call this alert and not let us know what the problem is.
Today, I read word that Senator Jackson has submitted a proposed emergency bill to open up PET 4 for exploration and development.
Mm-hmm.
What is your opinion of that bill?
Well, of course, I had announced some time back that as soon as the Alaska pipeline bill had passed, I would also introduce legislation to open up all of the petroleum reserves. The only difference between Jackson's bill and my bill is that he would have the government spend the money to go ahead and drill it and build the lines and all of this. And this could come to some $2 million. But I think that the private sector of our economy is eminently more qualified to do this activity than the government. And so it would make a lot more sense if, rather than putting it out in bonus bid, but setting up some type of a royalty arrangement with private oil companies to go ahead and develop these finds. They would put up the money, they would use their expertise, and I think that the public would be better served than putting the government into an activity, into an enterprise where it has no experience and no expertise, and where I don't think it can serve any useful purpose.
Do you plan to oppose Jackson's bill then?
I won't oppose it, but undoubtedly I'll offer my own bill as an amendment to his.
Okay, one last question. Do you plan to run for re-election next year?
Well, I think that's too early a question to respond to. I'm a senator, my term doesn't expire until 1965, and that's a decision that I won't have to make, fortunately, until next May.
Thank you.
It was to be a routine interview, but it ran about 23 minutes. In previewing the tape, Broadcast Center News determined that the content of the interview warranted a full presentation to our viewers. We now present that interview by our news director with Senator Mike Gravel.
What does this worldwide military alert mean to you?
Well, I'm very surprised to the extent of it, Larry. As you know, it's the first time that we've gone this extensively since the Pueblo situation. And of course, we don't know the particulars. He's brought in the leadership of the Congress and briefed them this morning. I don't know the exchange of information between the Soviet Union and the United States. All we know is Dr. Kissinger went over there and things were going along very well. We insist that we have a peacekeeping force from the United Nations rather than the Soviets and ourselves. So I just don't know whether or not the gravity of the situation warrants this type of an alert situation. I do know that I have the same question mark as most Americans, is that, you know, with the harassment he has domestically over the possibility of impeachment, is he trying to pull some patriotic stunt, so to speak, of making himself more into the role of the commander-in-chief to take away from the domestic problems relative to impeachment? If that's the case, then it's a very, very cruel hoax and a very, very serious one. I don't know what the facts are, and I'll reserve my judgment until more information comes out.
That question or that thought was asked of Dr. Kissinger at his news conference this morning, and he replied somewhat upset that that question was symptomatic of what's happening to the country. What did he mean by that?
Well, if he's talking about symptomatic, meaning a lack of faith and credibility in the president, then of course he's right. But then again, it wasn't the country that brought about this lack of credibility, it was the president himself. So that he can be angry over that, if this is a scenario, then they have every reason to be angry, because people aren't just buying it the way they're putting it out.
We're just out of Vietnam, sort of. Are we being drawn into another war now in the Mideast?
I hope not, and I think the Congress many times doesn't act with the courage that it should. But I'm sure in this particular situation that we'll demand more information before we go ahead and permit certain things to take place. But of course, the executive has an edge on us. He can do things more rapidly than we can. But there's a lot of talk about whether or not the president is balanced or under emotional stress. I hope that the leadership of the Congress that has close contact with him will keep that in mind, and I'm sure they will, and so that we in the Congress could act at any time. I'm subject to being called back and could be back at my desk in Washington in 12 hours, and I'm prepared to do just that. But in the absence of that, I plan on going back on Monday.
You would oppose the introduction of any U.S. troops in the Mideast?
It would depend upon the situation. I would say at this point, yes, I would oppose our sending troops to the Mideast. However, I have supported and will vote for the $2 billion request for supplying arms so that we have a parity in that area. And I think that that policy is a policy that will do the job, will be successful. And so I think it's in our interest to maintain parity. And I think with the proper parity, we won't have to send, or there'll be no need to send troops in. And at this point in time, I just wonder if there's any need to place the entire armed forces of the United States around the world on the alert.
Senator Gravel, we haven't talked personally with you since the events of Saturday and then this past Monday. Everyone's aware of them, what President Nixon did. What's your feeling about first the firing of Cox and then the decision to give Judge Sirica the tapes?
Well, I think what happened is the president miscalculated. I think he thought that he could fire Cox and that there'd be a little bit of a rhubarb and that he could weather that storm. But what he misjudged was that the American people had apparently identified on Mr. Cox, Elliot Richardson, and Mr. Ruppelhaus, identified with these individuals as the possibility that the truth might some ways get out, that these were honest men and that they were pursuing their appointed tasks. Now, the firing of Cox, I think, is just absolutely terrible. We in the Congress accepted Cox as the special prosecutor rather than appoint our own, because we were assured that he would be independent. And of course, as long as he was independent, that's fine. But apparently he was too independent and Richard Nixon had to fire him. I think he's destroyed the last ounce of credibility with the American people that justice would be done in the Watergate with his Justice Department or at his hands. The only recourse is, of course, for us in the Congress to appoint a special prosecutor. I personally would favor reappointing Mr. Cox as the special prosecutor, and that what we should do is initiate proceedings towards impeachment. Now, we have to be very precise about that, because I will sit as a juror
any if we do bring in an impeachment indictment. So I haven't made my mind up on the facts, because there are a lot of facts that I don't know. And so what the House has to do first is hold a hearing, develop the information as to whether or not the president has obstructed justice. And if so, then they'll turn around and indict him on a simple vote, and then it will be tried in the Senate.
It wouldn't prejudice you, though, to say here that you would encourage the House to continue with impeachment proceedings.
Well, very much. No, I feel very strongly about that. I think that there are sufficient grounds to begin an investigation. Now, I don't know if there are sufficient grounds to indict, but I think there are sufficient grounds to begin the investigation. That's all I've said. That's all I believe at this point in time, because I don't know what happened in the Cox investigation. I don't know what details precipitated a Cox firing. All of that we can find out. And as we find out, then we can make up our minds whether or not the president was really trying to cover his tracks on something.
Do you have an opinion on the president mentally? We went on the street to talk with people here, and the comments ranged from one person saying that he had every right to do what he did to the fact that one person felt he was crazy. How do you feel?
Well, I think he was shrewd, because I think the ground that he picked to fight on with Cox, he thought, was safer ground than waiting until the Supreme Court rendered a decision that he would have to release the tapes. So he thought it would be better to fire Cox than fly in the face of the Supreme Court. But what he misjudged was the sophisticatedness of the American public and how much confidence they reposed in the office of Mr. Cox that justice would be done. So when the president did that, he didn't realize that what happened was a tidal wave of national indignation, not led by anybody or not led by the Congress. We were all out of session. And this is legitimate indignation by the man in the street who says, why should he be above the law? This is a dictatorship if he can hold himself above the law. And that's the same fear I have. Those laws have to be applied to the lowest person in our society, to the highest person. That has not always been the case. And that's what can hurt democracy.
People are telling me they can't understand how President Nixon and his advisors would have misjudged something that was so obvious to them, so obvious that there would be an uproar of public indignation.
Well, but I don't think they realized how serious that uproar would be. I think they knew they'd catch some flack. But I think when Nixon started on this trajectory, that he didn't realize that Elliot Richardson would resign, and that Bill Ruckelshaus would resign. So all of this happened so precipitously that he could have, you know, got very angry and half a temper tantrum, and then just hung in there until all the events were done. But I'm sure that when he started out last Saturday morning, that he didn't think he would lose his attorney general and his deputy attorney general. All he wanted to lose was Cox. But he paid a dear price for that, I think probably a dearer price than he'll ever realize.
On another topic, let's talk about the pipeline bill again. The specter of a presidential veto was raised last week by Senator Ted Stevens, and again today we have reports out of Washington that Roy Ashe of the Office of Management and Budget has said to Congressman John Milcher, who chaired that conference committee, that there are four provisions, most related to the Federal Trade Commission, that are objectionable and that could lead to a presidential veto. What do you think?
I think it's wrong. I think they're using scare tactics. And I think if the president vetoes the Alaska pipeline bill, that he'd be derelict in his office. It's not enough to impeach him on, but he's made other stupid vetoes before. But stopping the Alaska pipeline when the Arabs have just shut off the oil would be, in my mind, insanity. First off, the 4 points in question and dispute are not major points. It's not enough to veto a bill over. Roy Ashe is mad because it takes a little bit of power away from his office, that the FTC can now send out questionnaires. Well, that's not a bad situation to diffuse power in Washington. It's too concentrated the way it is now. The second point is that the Congress should confirm Love as the energy czar, and also confirm the person who's the head of mine safety. Well, this isn't bad that these people are going to have important jobs. Why shouldn't the Congress have a chance to investigate and a quiz and then confirm these individuals? That's not reason enough to veto the Alaska pipeline. And if they do, I think you'll see some indignation here in Alaska. We fought pretty hard to get that pipeline through, and we got my amendment through to build it immediately by one vote. Now, if they run that thing back to the Congress, they're just causing a lot of difficulties that should not be there, and I don't think that we can be held accountable for their irresponsibility.
And you don't think, in fact, the president will veto that bill?
No, I don't think so. I think that would be a pretty stupid thing, and I can be critical of him of some stupid things, but I don't think he's that stupid.
And you think it's a good bill?
I think it's a reasonable bill. I don't think it's a perfect bill. There's things in it that I dislike. I think some items in there are discriminatory against Alaska. But I think it's a bill that we can get the pipeline built with, and that's what I want to do, is start building that pipeline now.
And without going into all the thoughts about antitrust suits and possible litigation in the federal courts again, do you still have the gut feeling that this construction will begin on the pipeline in the spring?
Very much so.
More so than before?
No, I still have the confidence that if we can get that bill signed by the president, that we'll be on our way.
On to another topic then. There's increasing talk about the Naval Petroleum Reserves, and of course ours is known as Naval Petroleum Reserve
PET-4.
And Senator John Tunney of California this past week talked of opening it. You, I understand, have introduced legislation to open it to private exploration and development, haven't you?
No, I've drafted the legislation. I've got it all drafted, ready to spring. All I'm waiting to do is till the Alaska pipeline gets out of the way, because I don't want to put it in and muddy the water. I want to wait until I get a good...
But you want PET-4 open?
Very much so. I think it's ridiculous to keep this oil locked up. We've got an energy crisis now. The crisis is going to be with us for the next 10 years. If there's ever a time we need it, it's now. It'll take about 3 years to put it online. So why not go ahead? When they say about saving it for the Navy buys its refined product. Navy doesn't have a refinery. They buy their refined product from the various oil companies in the nation. So that if we want to guarantee the Navy has the necessary fuel, what we'll do is we'll ration the rest of the nation. But that doesn't mean we should just hold this reserve the way it is now. What we need is the reserve opened up. This will give us the economic base to build another pipeline, to build additional gas lines, and to get the state...
Would your legislation open Elk Hills, Teapot Dome, and...
Yes, it would. And I think we could handle the dangers that some oil companies would rip it off. As you know, I've just been appointed chairman of the Subcommittee on Energy for the Finance Committee. And this subcommittee is going to have a lot to say about oil policy in this country.
I want to come back to that in just a moment.
But one of the things that I would advocate doing is, as we open up these things, is to maybe put on an excess profits tax so that nobody can make any excess profits and there'll be no ripoff. But at least the public will get the benefit of getting this energy to market.
How does your proposed legislation on the Naval Petroleum Reserves, and again, there are four of them, one here, two in California, one in Wyoming, differ from what Senator Henry Jackson is proposing that he's going to conduct here?
What Senator Jackson is talking about doing is having the government do it all, do the drilling, do the transmission of it, and then just hold it in reserve.
You want private industry to do it?
I want the private sector to do it, and I think we can get the private sector to do it. A lot of times can find areas where I think we should do more with government. But sometimes I find that we've got too much government. And the Scoop Jackson and I differ on this, as we've differed on many other subjects.
A moment ago you said, why not? Why not open them? Senator Ted Stevens was here last week and he gave a why not. He said that that PET-4 should remain locked up because it would depress the value of lands being claimed by natives, lands moving into the private sector, state lands, that these lands could be developed faster for oil, and they hold oil, and there could be a good market price for these lands, that we can develop this land faster, we don't have to worry about a federal impact statement and that kind of thing. So he says, keep PET-4 locked up, let's keep the market value high on these other lands.
Yeah, I disagree 180 degrees. There's more need for energy than we can supply. All we're talking about with this pipeline is 2 million barrels a day. With the Canadian pipeline, we're talking about another 2 million, that's 4 million. With a Canadian gas line and an El Paso gas line, we're talking the equivalent of another million barrels each, that's 6 million barrels. We need, in order to avoid bankruptcy in the United States, upwards of 10 million barrels a day. So it's not a question of trying to measure with an eyedropper what will work right now. We need to do every possible thing we can do to get in the proper direction to begin to develop these resources to save our country. So I think that that's worrying about something that's passe, that's ancient history.
Now back to what you mentioned a moment ago, you serve on the Senate Finance Committee, and you have been named chairman of that committee, subcommittee on energy. How potent an assignment is that?
Well, let's look at it this way. The Finance Committee is the most powerful committee in the Senate. The energy problem is the most important problem that our nation faces, leaving aside Watergate and impeachment and the Middle Eastern War. And the Middle Eastern War slightly involves with this. So the number one national issue is energy. The most powerful committee in the Senate is the Finance Committee, and I've just become chairman of the Energy Committee on the Finance Committee. And from Alaska's point of view, the most important thing to Alaska is energy, is our oil. And so here I sit in a position nationally, also a position that has can have great benefit to the state.
Well, pardon this question, then, Senator Gravel. Sometimes your critics accuse you of grandstanding, and I had a feeling that this was a significant assignment, and there was very little said about it out of your office or out of anyone else.
Well, first off, the assignment was made on the day that Spiro Agnew resigned. So that I was a little crushed by the events of the day. But give you an example, the Anchorage Times, which has given more press to my house that I'm building in Washington, has put it on page 13. I got more press than Cox's firing got on the front page on Monday in Anchorage. And this appointment of this most important position for Alaska was on page 13. It just goes to show you how some of the press can, I say some of the press now, can be very diabolically negative and trying to give false appearances.
Your good friends at the Anchorage Daily Times have indeed talked about your house. You're building one on the Potomac, and they say that it has, what, 18 rooms?
No, they have 14 rooms. What they did, they counted the corridors, they counted the hallways, and they counted the bathrooms. Now, I've been in real estate and know how you can futz around with these things. Well, in point of fact, the house that I had in Anchorage before I got elected had 2,600 square feet, and this house that I'm building has 4,300 square feet, so that's about 1,400 more square feet thereabouts now after being in Washington 5 years. Rita and I have been renting for 5 years. We've been saving our money. When I sold my house in Anchorage, I took the equity to buy this property. We kept paying for 5 years until we could afford a mortgage, as you build up enough equity so you can get a mortgage, and now I've got a big mortgage. And if I choose to run and serve in Washington, I'll be able to maintain this credit and keep paying on my mortgage. If I don't run, then I'll probably do well in the financial area privately and pay it off that way. So either way, it's we just wanted to have a nice home. We're homebodies and want to do some entertaining at home rather than have to entertain the outside.
I know you haven't officially said whether you're going to seek re-election, but we all suspect you will. And is this an indication, building the home on the Potomac?
No, I don't think you can assume that. I've got to live somewhere. And like I said, we've been renting for 5 years, and it's about time we built.
One final question. A moment ago, you said that you were 180 degrees different than Senator Stevens on Pet 4. I can't help but believe you're also in that position on the compass on the subject of Fort Wainwright. Now, he hesitated to say as much, but he talked apparently to the House Armed Services Committee and got some kind of agreement that the north post of Fort Wainwright will remain under military control. You had gone to the Office of Economic Adjustment in the Pentagon to try and find some economic disposition for that north post. He never liked that, and I can't see where you two are very much together on
that. No, I disagree with that approach because...
Disagree with Stephen's approach?
Yeah, well, it's very simple. He has worked all along to try and keep the military there. That's fine. We tried to do that in Kodiak, and the military left. We tried to do that at Wildwood Air Force Station in Kenai, and the military left. And so the military now want to cut down on the North Post. Now, we can pass all the resolutions we want, send them all the letters that we want, but if they have decided that they're wasting money in their budget, they don't want to continue that activity, we ought to at least be smart enough to say, well, fine, they're going to cut it out. And what we ought to do is try and do something productive with that piece of real estate. So all I've advocated is the military said they don't want to use the real estate. Now, we can keep let them have it in their ownership, and they won't use it. And what happens? The town gets hurt. It's going to be there. The building is going to be empty. The military will still have title to it, but who's really going to get hurt? It'll be the people of Fairbanks. So what I'm trying to do is to get another piece of economic activity to use that real estate to provide some action that will benefit not only Fairbanks, but the whole state. And so I've been working on trying to make part of North Post into a laboratory for the Earth's satellite system. And we've been working very hard with NASA, and a lot of people in this town have been working hard on this project. Bob Parsons and others, the borough chairman, city councilman, have come back to Washington and sat down with Dr. Fletcher and tried to sell him on the needs for this community. Now, all of this could be blown out of the tub by the efforts in the House to keep this in the hands of the military. If they want to keep it in the hands of the military, let them station some troops there and use the
You don't believe these things, such as, in Dr. Fletcher, you mentioned, is the administrator of NASA, you don't believe these things, such as the NASA lab or continued use by the BLM, can take place while it's under military ownership? You would prefer that it move into some other ownership?
Well, maybe it can take place under the military, but that's really not what they're after. They're after turning that back to the military in the hopes that the military will use it. And I think that that's naive. I think the track record's very clear that when the military don't want to use any property,
you're saying
that
Senator Stevens is naive about his approach to this?
No, I don't want to put words in Larry. You know, you're a better reporter than that. I'm just expressing my view.
It's a naive approach.
That I think that it's naive to think that we can beat the military at their own bureaucratic game. And all I cite is our track record, where we've never been able to do it. I don't think we'll ever be able to. And I don't think we should be able to do it, because they work with their budget. They know their needs. And if they say they don't need that North Post and they want to surplus it, then who should we be to turn around and say, well, look, you've got to keep it going because of the economy? I think that's wrong. I think what we got to do is take a constructive approach and say, okay, they say they don't need it. Let's find another use for it. And this other use that I'm talking about, an Earth satellite laboratory, would be not only be more valuable economically to the community of Fairbanks, but would be more valuable to the economic community of the state of Alaska.
You, Senator Gravel, were en route to Alaska and have been in Alaska since this announcement was made. What's the possibility of you, when you return to Washington, going to the House Armed Services Committee and giving them your side of the story? Committee's changed their mind.
No, I think that Mr. Hebert, who's what you'd consider very hawkish, probably wouldn't be too interested in receiving testimony to accept facts as they are. I don't know all the details of what's
Congressman Edward Hebert of that committee is
the
more
chairman of the Armed Services.
He's more inclined to go along with what Stevens has to say?
I would say he'd be more inclined to go along with the expansion of the military if he thought it could wash.
So you
and
don't
probably Congressman Hebert's only heard one side of the story. But here's what the end product will be. If they keep the North Post in the hands of the military and they don't station anybody out there, they just close the doors up and let the buildings sort of just rot away.
You aren't going to try then in the Congress to reverse the decision on the retention of the North Post?
Well, first off, I'm not even sure that decision's binding. Well, it's just the Hebert's opinion and the committee's opinion. Who says that the military are going to go?
Well, the Army spokesman for the Pentagon said that that's therefore what the Army's going to do.
Did he say that?
Well, that's what he's reported as saying.
Well, I'll investigate this a little bit, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you.
The preceding interview with Senator Mike Gravel was taped in our studio earlier today. Our news director, Larry Carpenter, conducted the interview. Technical direction by Bob Hartman. This program was a production of Broadcast Center News, where what you want to know comes first. With the best of CBS and ABC.